Monster Man, special episode, Mythical Makeovers. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Elias. If you'd like to be like Elias and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Elias, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Now, Elias gave me a set of topics to choose from, one that I was too scared to engage with, Glorianthan mythology, one that I don't know enough about to talk about, monsters of the role-playing game Heart. And in the middle, he asked about making monsters from classical mythology work in modern games. Now, not games set in the modern day, but just games being played in the modern day. And apparently, this is something that he feels Heart does well, which I haven't read. I keep meaning to. And I think that this is actually quite a challenge, because it's both the case that these monsters are very central to our thinking about monsters and supernatural beings in general, but also that they suffer when they're used for, I was going to say for horror purposes, but actually I just generally mean in a way that's meant to be taken seriously. I have some qualifications for that, but broadly speaking, I think these are not necessarily the most successful monsters in fantasy RPGs. They need a little bit of a tune-up. Hello everyone, it's me, your old friend, James from the future. This insert sounds a little bit different because I am on my traveling microphone in a hotel room in Edinburgh. But I wanted to just drop it in and give some context for today's episode, because when I went back to read my original email from the listener who asked for it, I realized that he was really talking about monsters from familiar mythology or fairy tales generally, and not just creatures from classical mythology. Now, I think that the majority of what I have said really applies to all of these things. So the danger of classical mythology creatures in games is that they are familiar, and that's also true of fairy tale creatures. I do think that there's something to be said for using traditional fairy tale creatures or traditional creatures from other mythologies to establish a particular kind of atmosphere that maybe doesn't work as well with creatures from classical myth, but I'd be willing to be convinced otherwise about that. So sometimes you want to stick closely to these types of creature and not change them up too much because you're going for a specific aesthetic. But I think if you're not, you can still apply these same ideas to creatures from any over-familiar mythology and try to use them in your game. Anyway, without further ado, and with thanks for your patience, I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. When you're a kid, some of the first mythology that you're exposed to is ancient Greek, right? The Hydra, Medusa, Talos, the Man of Bronze, you know, whether it's cartoons or books. I mean, I haven't read a Percy Jackson book since they post-date me being a kid, but that stuff's all in there. Or it's Clash of the Titans, which was sort of always on TV when I was younger. Whether it's through art or video games, whatever it is, or even just books of mythology, right? There are a lot of books about Greek mythology aimed at kids. There's classical myth all over public art in many Western nations. But I feel like because it's something that you can learn about in school, and because there's a possibility that there's a carving of it on the side of a bank or whatever, there's an association of the classical world with the establishment. You know, it's kind of the official mythology. I don't know why that is specifically. You don't see scenes from the Bible on the side of a bank. And it may be because classical mythology is from the ancient world, it's seen as being just a sign of being cultured, that you know about it, but it's not necessarily a statement of belief. So it's a very neutral thing to do a piece of art about, I suppose. But This means that classical mythology takes on all of the qualities that we associate with children's books and school and, you know, institutions, from banks to universities. It is square. It feels kind of staid. Although this is a weird thing to say about something that is thousands of years old, it feels old-fashioned. Feels very 19th century to be very interested in classical mythology. And that's a shame, because there's a lot of fun and interesting stuff in these myths that would be a really enjoyable addition to game if you can present it in a way that feels engaging for players. So how do we do that when people have these existing, I don't even want to say opinions, but just kind of associations with them? I think there are several ways to try and approach introducing creatures from classical, you know, Roman or Greek mythology into a game. The first is to present them a little bit differently. So sometimes to overcome the problems of familiarity, the problem of a lot of classical monsters, not all, but the problem of a lot of classical monsters is that they're meant to be strange, but we're very familiar with them. So if you take, I don't know, a chimera, we have a word for that, and indeed we use that word to mean other things as well. And that takes some of the strangeness out of what is in fact a very strange monster. Because of its literary ubiquity, classical mythology, almost more than any other form of mythology or folklore, is very present in other contexts. So like we will call someone a harpy, or, you know, we describe a genetic condition as being a chimera. Familiarity can be a problem, and one way to deal with the challenge of familiarity is to treat a familiar thing as though it were unfamiliar. I am someone who both travels a lot internationally, but also doesn't travel very much internationally, by which I mean that it's not uncommon for me to go to another country, but it's almost always the same country, and indeed it's almost always the same place, because if I'm going to make such a big trip, it's going to be to visit my family. So I have been to Palo Alto, California, a lot of times in my life, you know, even when I was no longer living there. In the mid-20-teens, my wife and I made a new plan for dealing with being in Palo Alto. Because the thing about being in the suburbs, which is essentially where I grew up, is that it's a nice place to live, but you wouldn't want to visit. You wind up with free time, right? You're not hanging out with your old school friends every minute of the day. So we decided to visit the place as though we were tourists in a place we had actually lived for a long time. So we started going to museums, and like I went to the Pez Museum, which was amazing. Or we went to historic houses, things like that, you know, all things that tourists would do. We didn't actually go to Alcatraz, but it's not outside the realm of possibility. Treating a place that you've frequently been as though you were a tourist allows you to do things that locals don't do, but that are still fun. To see the same place, a place that you know very well, with new eyes. Or let's say you've been married for a long time and you're not doing fun stuff anymore, right? Like you feel like you just sit at home and you spend all your time cleaning up after the kids or whatever. It's not uncommon for people to sort of start arranging things that you would expect more of a younger relationship, right? Going on dates, trying to make things special occasions. Go on a first date again with someone with whom you're already in a relationship. You can do this kind of thing with anything that you have a real and lasting connection to. It doesn't work if what you're getting out of it is just surprise or a twist. There are movies that have twists in them that you can watch many, many times, and there are movies that have twists in them that you can only watch once. So I think you can apply this kind of logic to a monster. Treat it as though it were completely unfamiliar, and you will give it back some of its unfamiliarity. Instead of telling the player characters that they see a harpy, describe it directly, right? The cruel expression, the hooked claws, the terrible stench, or the flowing lovely hair. You have options. Focus on what makes the creature what it is, instead of assuming that the player characters already know all those things, even though they do. It's not just the fact that they already know it, but your assumption that they already know it that is contributing to the sense of boredom about this monster. And that's not specific to the ancient world. You can do that with a lot of older monsters. You can also extrapolate from basic concepts to do this. So think about what a creature would be like that had a goat, lion, and dragon head, and then play the chimera that way. This allows players themselves to kind of find the thing and discover that it's a chimera, maybe changing their perspective on a little bit. Now, that type of naturalism isn't the kind of thing that those myths were concerned with, by any means, but it is another way to see an existing creature with fresh eyes. Method number two, go back to basics. The art and literature of ancient Greece is not quite the same thing as the version of those myths that we find in modern popular culture. But your exposure to modern popular culture, all of our exposure, I'm not like saying you, for many people, exposure to modern popular culture does give us an interpretive framework through which we process our contact with earlier texts. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it can be helpful to try to remove the preconceptions that you have. A good example of this is like, I don't remember the first time I read Frankenstein. I didn't read it until quite late. I was in my 20s when I read it, and I genuinely found it hard not to visualize the Boris Karloff Frankenstein when I was reading it. You know, it's just such an iconic image. Similarly, if you're constantly surrounded by, yeah, here's Zeus with his beard and his zigzag thunderbolt, and here's Clash of the Titans or other interpretations of that, or, you know, Disney's Hercules or whatever your particular childhood interpretation of those myths is, that tells you something about a kind of character framework that you then interpret Zeus through. But if you go back and read, you know, some poem or some story about Zeus, and Zeus is being weird and enigmatic, which is sometimes the case, don't try to map it onto an understanding of a personality. Just let it be baffling. I was reading a thing. I don't remember where this was. Probably on Twitter, but it could have been somewhere else. You may not know this, but for a while, and maybe they're done with it, but for a while, the young internet people were very fascinated, and maybe they still are, by the stories of Hades and Persephone. Now, I don't know if this is because of the video game, but they were thinking about it a lot. And a lot of it was attempting to parse that myth through their understandings of a romantic relationship. So some people viewed it as a kind of gothic tragedy about separated lovers, and others viewed it as a horror story about an abductor who seizes this girl and takes her away from her family. And they thought it was pretty bad that group number one were romanticizing what they interpreted as a kind of abusive relationship. But of course, both of these interpretations are grounded in the human and the familiar. Now, that is part of a Greek myth, but it's only a part. Indeed, the uncanniness, the supernaturalness of these stories comes from the juxtaposition of what is mythic and what is mundane. You can see this in the Chimera as well, which has a head of a dragon and also the head of a goat. We can see that these are multiple interpretations of the same basic concept. Because remember that the protagonist of the story of Hades and Persephone is Demeter. At least, certainly, I think this is how Hesiod tells it, is from Demeter's perspective. So if you were a mother, like, take interpretation one, the love affair interpretation. Well, if you were a mother, it can seem like when your daughter falls in love, she's stolen away from you. She's always with this other person, you know, she never calls, she never writes. It can seem like a lover takes your child away and never returns her. And if we go with second interpretation, the more horrific interpretation, closer to the myth, obviously you could say the same thing about an abductor. But this thing that I was reading was saying it's easiest to understand this if you don't try to understand these two as human people at all. You know who takes someone you love away from you and never returns them? Death. He's not a guy. He's death. And that's what death does. There are people you care about and death takes them and never gives them back. And you can demand mercy from the gods, but all you're going to get from Hecate is, this is the command of Zeus. It's wild that they get her back at all, right? That's the miracle. The miracle in the story of Hades and Persephone isn't that the girl is taken away, but that she's partly returned. So if you want to make Hades, often portrayed as, you know, a gloomy king keeping cheerless state in the underworld, blah, blah, blah. If you want to make him matter in a game, you got to remember, he is death. Implacable death. I'm sorry if that stuff about taking someone you love away and never returning them was pretty heavy. But it is. I mean, it's a heavy story. Option number three, make it contemporary. So one way to think about incorporating classical monsters into, you know, a fantasy setting or any kind of other setting is maybe to think about the principles that underlie the creation of these monsters. Creation's a weird word, but you know what I mean? That underlie how these monsters function. So classical monsters are often about the combination of unlike elements or using seemingly natural elements to emphasize a kind of metaphor. So, or they're about violation of boundaries, about people who are where they ought not to be, flying too close to the sun or gazing on the goddess bathing. There are similarities that we can observe between creatures like the Chimera, the Sphinx, Medusa, Pegasus, whatever. Can we replicate those principles using other symbols? And it's not as simple as just combining unlike elements. Like, consider the Chimera of the Sphinx. That's not the same thing as a cyborg. So you think about probably the most common, you know, hybrid monster of modern genre fiction, the cyborg. The point of a cyborg is that the cyborg has something to say about technology, or if it's a biological thing, has something to say about genetic engineering. But the Chimera doesn't have anything to say about lions, it's the other way around. The Chimera is using the fact that you already have an emotional understanding that relates to lions, and suggesting that the monster partakes of that in some way. It is using a recognizable symbol in an unfamiliar context. The storyteller and the audience have a shared understanding of that symbol already. So what contemporary creatures have those qualities? It's a little too naturalistic for this to be the case, but I do think that the Brundlefly from The Fly does have some of this. It's more science fictional. It has more of that kind of thought experiment quality where you go, well, I know what a fly is like, therefore what would it be like at a human scale? It'd be super gross. But I do think that if you want to take symbols that you think you and your players already have some kind of shared understanding of, those can be used to create new monsters. And I do think this is also why some monsters kind of haven't lost their shine. The Minotaur would be one good example, although the friendly, lovable dope of a Minotaur is an equally common trope now, and that is, of course, in large part because we've changed a lot of the way we feel about bulls. They're not the most powerful, I guess, image of raw physical strength that most people encounter. If we were going to create a monster in the modern day that had that quality of uncontrolled power, we'd make it a tank or something. 4. Go to the source. And by the source, I mean Typhon and Echidna. You know what doesn't get enough attention and representation in Greek mythology? Typhon and Echidna, the parents of all these weird monstrous creatures. They don't turn up in games very often, although Typhon is important in Werewolf the Apocalypse of all things. Give me a good take on Typhon and Echidna, somebody. You might need to change the name Echidna, because obviously here in 2023, if you say Echidna, what that means to people is spiny anteater, and that's less threatening. I think you can do this by changing the aesthetics. So take Medusa, for instance. Though Medusa is a pretty effective creature, but because of her power, I feel like in D&D, Medusa is typically viewed, you know, a Medusa, that whole thing. But Medusa is typically viewed as a gimmick creature, right? It has one power and then you think Medusa, you think mirror. But the idea of a priestess cursed for, depending on what version of the story you want to listen to, something that she had no real control over, cursed by a god that you're supposed to be broadly sympathetic to, you know, that reveals a harsher and stranger universe of the divine than we're used to thinking of. One where, like, if we had to pick an alignment for Athena, we would say lawful good, right? But one where your lawful good deity imposed a punishment on somebody that was pretty clearly unjust, again, depending on the interpretation of the myth that you want to use. Presumably on the grounds that the rules are the rules, and she doesn't care whether you intended to break them or not, even if you were forced to break them. Cursed and turned into a monster, a curse that punishes her, certainly, but also everyone else. You know, honestly, the more I contemplate this Medusa, the more I'm starting to wonder whether the gods really have our best interests at heart at all. Is she just kind of doing this to make a point? And this cursed former priestess turned into a monster so unutterably hideous that the sight of her will turn you to stone has actually become a symbol. People paint the head of the Gorgon on their shields as a way of saying, I'm as scary as Medusa. I'll paralyze you with terror. And I think you can kind of just take away the snaky hair and maybe even the turning to stone, replace it with some other kind of terrifying status effect, and you have a monster that doesn't have the kind of... Because we have a nostalgic feeling about Ray Harryhausen's Medusa. And on the one hand, we remember how eerie and threatening that scene is, but on the other hand, our memory of that eerie threat, because it is nostalgic, is a warm and comforting memory. It's a bit of a funny situation, and you probably want to avoid your presentation of Medusa being warm and comforting. But I think if you just made her face a terrifying void, or the image of your own death, or something like that, I mean, if you think Medusa is a little too nostalgic and doesn't have that sense of unfamiliarity, the snakes aren't really the most important part of the whole thing. You can change that up. It's the thing that you can't bear to look at that really matters. And I bet we can think of some things that people can't bear to look at. Sometimes it's just about thinking about what the meaning is of the thing, or at least the meaning of the thing in your game, because obviously these are subject to a wide range of different interpretations, but you know, we get to pick the interpretation that we want to use in our game. And if you do that, you can give the aesthetics a little tweak, and probably you're good to go. So that is what I have to say about making monsters from the classical world effective in modern games. Elias, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, please remember that if you'd like to be like Elias and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Now, normally here I would tell you what is in our next episode, but because I'm traveling this week, the schedule is a little bit disrupted, and I actually don't know which episode is going to be next. Depending on the editing process, it may even be a short special episode recorded from the road. So we'll see how it all goes, but either way, I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.